You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191, by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. 15 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 9, given in Dornach on the 19th of October, 1919. In our reflections, I have been highlighting, from many different angles, the connection between embracing spiritual scientific insights and the view of society that must increasingly become widespread in humanity. It is likely that in the process, you will have felt a need to examine one question more thoroughly. What is the inner relationship between socially committed actions and the sensibility that can develop in us as a consequence of gradually living our way into spiritual scientific ideas? Spiritual scientific ideas initially reveal to us a certain inner mood of soul by helping us understand something, human destiny, which we witness in ordinary life and yet must often experience as incomprehensible. This human destiny becomes comprehensible to some degree when we become acquainted with the law of recurring lives on earth and the laws of karma connected with this. We learn to see that our journey through one life on earth is dependent on former lives on earth. We have already spoken, after all, of the forces that play over from one life into another, and have learned in some respects how destiny works and is shaped and configured by the cosmos. Now all of you will have a sense that if a person today does not gain higher insights, he can only have a dim inkling of how his destiny is shaped by succeeding lives on earth. What we call karma is something that can be understood relatively easily. You can gather this from the last edition of my book titled Theosophy and the changes I made to the chapter concerning karma. But the real perception of life I spoke about yesterday, that straightforward view of life, unobscured by prejudice and preconception, which would immediately reveal the law of karma, is something that very few people as yet possess. If people were to see what happens in life with the straightforward, unprejudiced vision I spoke of yesterday, healthy human reason would speak of the laws of destiny in the same way as spiritual science does. But so far this is not the case for the majority of people. Most people do not have the simple capacity to see that would bring home to them how I, capital, consciousness, lives within the soul. There are even philosophers today who speak of I, consciousness, as if this were the most certain, sure, and real thing that exists. We can say that this is as true on the one hand as it is one-sided, and indeed almost untrue on the other. How, in fact, do we actually perceive our human I? Yesterday you learned how, in respect of inner life, thinking is really only a reflection of life before birth, and how the life of will is an embryonic or germinal prelude to life after death, and in other words, how what weaves in our soul does not fundamentally belong to the bodily sheath that encloses us from birth to death. Our extra-physical, extra-temporal being plays into our thinking, on the one hand, and into our will on the other. But you know, too, how we look back on our life and have the sense that our previous life lies behind us as memory. It is very easy for us human beings to think that we have passed through life consciously and retain it in our memory back to the point where our memory begins. It seems to us as if this here, and there's a drawing, is the present moment, and that we remember continuously back to the moment in childhood of our first memory. You can easily discover, though, that this is very mistaken. If you trace the course of your life back to the moment in childhood of your first memory, and regard this as a continuous current, that is, of course, completely wrong. For in this retrospective view, you really only perceive occurrences of waking life. In fact, each succeeding day is interrupted by a night when you perceive nothing. Each succeeding day is interrupted by a night. It is, therefore, completely illusory to ignore the fact that this retrospective memory of your life, this conscious memory, is not a complete current, but one, in fact, continually interrupted by all the periods when you were asleep and remembered nothing. The line of recall is therefore not a continuous, but a discontinuous one, a sequence of memories continually interrupted. To clarify what I mean, I would like to offer a picture at this point. Imagine a white disk within which is a black spot. What do you see? The white disk, and where there is no white, you see the black spot. Let's leave aside the question of whether the black spot is something real or only the absence of white. You see the black spot, and where you see it, no white can be seen on an otherwise white disk. This is an image, really, of how you perceive your I, capital, in ordinary life. Just as you do not perceive anything here at the center, and there is a drawing, where the black spot is, so you do not perceive your actual I. You do not perceive it at all. But you perceive the experiences you underwent each time you were awake, but not your I, not at all. Only by virtue of the fact that when you survey your experiences, they are not present, just as there is no white here in the black spot, do you perceive your I. As you look back on your life, you perceive your experiences, but do not experience the interruptions. Instead, you perceive your I. It is therefore the lack of waking experiences that in reality gives you the picture of your I. In other words, when you say I, you are perceiving the period of your life during which you were asleep and unaware. It is true. The unperceived, the unremembered parts of your life, when you look back, are the cause of your I perception. If you did not sleep at all, were always awake, you would have no perception of your I as you look back. You would appear to yourself as an eyeless being swimming in the flux of cosmic existence. It is extraordinarily important to see these things simply, straightforwardly. Everyone thinks that perception of the I is an experience. No. We perceive the I as a whole, or void, in our experiences. Please, keep this in mind for now. And now, I'd like to ask you to remember, as I have said so often, that we do not only sleep when we sleep, but we are also asleep when we're awake. We are only really awake in respect of the world of our senses and thoughts. In respect of our will, we are asleep. Just as little as we know what we accomplish during sleep, so likewise we cannot perceive the inner impulses of our will. Yesterday I said how a person can observe his own actions, but not see the will itself. We are asleep in our will. Insofar as we have will impulses, we are asleep in the daytime too. We are awake only in so much as we can perceive through our senses and form rational concepts, ideas. But we are only half awake. Even when we're awake, we are asleep in the other part of our being, the part that wills. And now you will understand how things stand with the eye. It does not enter at all as a real entity into your sense perceptions and your thoughts, but remains below, in the will, continuing to sleep there during waking life. This is why you can never see it as an actual entity, as real presence, but only as the empty spot at the center. You can have the dim sense that you possess an eye, in that something of what you have there as a whole in your soul experiences resounds for you from the will. But your perception of the eye is very much a negative one, and it is extraordinarily important to recognize this. We have to recognize the nullity of the superficial picture of the eye that figures too in many modern philosophies. You see, only when we comprehend this whole set of circumstances I have described here, can we understand, inwardly understand, the relationship between one person and another in life. I described this relationship between one person and another in new material added to the latest edition of my title, Philosophy of Freedom. Besides perceiving our own eye, albeit negatively as I have described, we also perceive the eye of another person. We would not be able to do so if we ourselves were conscious of our own eye. If the eye dwelt in our own consciousness, the relationship between people would be fatally demolished. We would pass through the world and would only ever have I, and I in our mind, in our world of sense perceptions and thoughts. We would pass others by and feel them only to be shadows, would be surprised when, on extending a hand, these shadows took hold of our hand. It would be inexplicable to us why our hand did not simply pass through the ghost of another person. This would all be down to the fact of possessing the eye as substantial entity, and not just as a negative picture in our thoughts and sense perceptions. But we do not possess it like this. We have it only in our will, and the feeling that emanates from the will. There, the actual I exists, but not directly in our life of thoughts and sense perceptions. In perceiving another person, we actually perceive him through our will. Those who regard themselves as philosophers today quite often entertain the crazy notion that in meeting another person, we encounter a pattern of forms. Up above his hair, then a forehead, a nose, a mouth, and so on. Since we have often seen ourselves in the mirror, we know that he looks like we do, and since we have an eye, we conclude, by analogy, that the other person also possesses one. This is preposterous, complete nonsense. In fact, we perceive the other person's eye exactly as we perceive our own, albeit negatively. And precisely because our eye is not in our mind, our consciousness, but outside it, like will also, we can transpose ourselves into the other person's eye. If the eye dwelt within our conscious mind, we would not be able to do this. and would perceive the other only as a shadowy existence. Now, how does the perception of the other person occur? A very complex process occurs here. We meet another person, and he commands our attention in some way, and very briefly lulls us asleep. He hypnotizes us, lulls us asleep for a very brief moment. Consequently, our sense of our humanhood is very briefly lulled asleep. We defend ourselves against this and assert our personality. This is like the swing of a pendulum, sleeping into the other, awakening in ourselves, sleeping into the other again, awakening in ourselves. And this complex process of oscillation between falling asleep in the other and awakening in ourselves is what happens when we meet someone. This is a process in our will. But we do not perceive it because we do not perceive our will at all. But this vibrating back and forth nevertheless occurs, as I describe in my title, Philosophy of Freedom. In this oscillation between falling asleep in the other and awakening in ourselves, we have the archetypal element, in a sense the nucleus of social community between people. This is the Ur element of social interaction and interplay. This original element, and thus also all the complex forms of social interplay, therefore dwell in the part of our being that sleeps even when we are awake. The life of society is essentially, at most, a dreaming entity in our waking experience, not fully awake. And this is why it is so hard to grasp social dynamics in ordinary life, since they do not unfold in a fully waking state, but in a life of dream. And since, in order to maintain ourselves within ourselves, we must continually defend ourselves against social instincts, against empathy with the other. Now, just consider how complicated it makes our life to enter into relationships with all kinds of people that involve repeatedly falling asleep and waking up. One person is of one kind, another of another. We fall asleep in the other, and this sleep partakes of the other's nature. We are subsumed by him as we fall asleep in him. If you imagine you have been speaking to various people, for instance, during our break in proceedings here, then you must recognize that you slept into all of them, and having awoken again from them, something of them is in turn always within you. Thus, you imbibe something of the being of each of these other people. All this vibrates between you, swells between one person and the other. Basically, it is a dim, dark element that reigns in this social interplay between people. And our modern consciousness does not partake in much of this social feeling that weaves and swells between one person and another. The task we have today in the modern world, as you can see from various reflections of ours, is gradually to emerge from the old blood relationships and raise ourselves to an understanding of the dim, obscure weft of social relationships. It is one of the most important missions of our era to gain insight into this weft and swell of personal interactions. What I have called the, quote, threefolding of the social organism, close quote, basically refers only to a pattern of human community in which the human being gradually might become able, after a number of generations, to take up this interweaving between people with true understanding. Such understanding can only arise if the life of rites and the life of spirit and culture come to exist autonomously alongside economic life. And especially if the life of spirit can stand in complete freedom beside the other two realms of life. To undertake this threefolding of society is the most vital public task for humanity today and in the near future. Only then can humanity survive and develop a truly social inner grasp of human life. In the modern era, since the middle of the 15th century, humanity has begun to develop this understanding. It is difficult today only because the divine spiritual powers are for the first time calling upon human consciousness. All progress made hitherto was brought about more or less unconsciously. What we first need to do now is to work consciously to create a social structure. Old social structures emerged from blood ties, from the nuclear and extended family, the tribe, the class, and so on. And these expanded to become nations. Today, humanity flounders about in nationhood because people wrongly believe they can still perceive these old forms and contexts. In fact, we have long superseded them, and the need has long since arisen to develop different forms of social community from those embodied in ties of blood and race. I said to you that the first stage on this journey toward social understanding, necessary today and in the near future, was heralded by the dominance of economic man since the Reformation. I pointed out that in ancient times the initiate held sway, later giving way to the priest, and how, since the mid-15th century, economic man has become dominant. Since the Reformation, those who previously wore cloaks of purple and pulled the strings of power became the puppets of Homo economicus, if they wished to rule. In truth, since the middle of the 15th century, economists have ruled, the figures who took care of the economies of diverse regions of the earth. Although others were the titular rulers, they were so in name only, and governments were really entirely pervaded by economic principles. Of course, people don't like speaking about everything since the Reformation being done from an economic perspective. They prefer to speak of ideals and so forth. But these are merely masks, concealing what the real actors on the stage of history were about. To make sure the veil was not lifted too much on this truth, ministers of culture, education, justice, and so on have gone on being appointed since the Reformation. But in fact, they were all somewhat diluted finance ministers. If you examine realities, you can see that at most such roles were a continuation of old traditions, but under a largely economic aspect. In this context, the Catholic Church knew how to be very contemporary, precisely in the era of the Reformation. It ensured that progress was entirely in accord with the new economic principles. To illustrate this, we need only consider one among many facts. Up to this point, the Church had succeeded in bringing about a close connection between the loftiest spiritual matters and the most trivial, mundane concerns. In olden times, you could make recompense for your sins by all kinds of actions, but gradually it became possible for you to pay for them in cash instead. Faster, really, than the other worldly powers, the Pope counted on these modern advances. He began to assure his future income from this penance for sins. If you have the power to make people pay you for absolving them from the sins they have committed, this represents an enormous future income. And if this is assured, as it can be by human faith, the income becomes very secure. The biggest CNE's bank, therefore, thought it was very secure business to purchase from the Pope a given number of such future penances. Making fulsome use of these funds, the Pope drew vast sums from the bank in Siena, and the bank appointed Tetzel to levy them. He went around the countries of Central Europe gathering in the absolution funds for this Sienese bank. So, as you see, the Church became very adept at employing modern conditions to its advantage. These historical facts must be carefully considered. Homo economicus emerged. The Church was there, but ultimately its administration of spiritual matters became, with the help of the bank in Siena and its debt collector, its agent, only a mask of spirituality. If you study recent history, you will certainly find deep significance in the rise to dominance of economic man. The Pope only remained as strong a ruler as he was because he recognized the right moment to become an economist also, incorporating homo economicus into his position and function. Yes, homo economicus came to dominance from the Reformation onward, succeeding the older figure of the priest. Only in the 19th century did humanity in general arrive at the stage which the Church, with its far greater understanding of progress, had already come to at the time of the Reformation. But this economist type prevailed only into the 19th century, and then gave way to yet another type. In saying that this new type became dominant, we mean that it came to control the structure of society. In the first couple of decades of the 19th century, the usurer, or banker, became dominant. If you seek a true definition of the banker, you find that history becomes extremely touchy about it. If it is mostly avoided, you study real underlying socio-economic factors to discover a definition of the figure of the banker, whether great or small. Be careful to avoid seeking a definition of the usurer, too, for in fact the two definitions closely resemble each other, inevitably. And this is a secret that has been carefully guarded in recent times, just as certain secret societies have guarded their symbols, in quotes, and phrases, in quotes, rather than scattering their pearls, in quotes, before humanity in general. This remained hidden in ordinary society. Bankers became dominant, and if we examine how social structures developed during the 19th century, we find that in the first couple of decades of that century, the banker, this specific economic type, whose economic activity involves only money, came to exert his decisive influence, as Homo economicus had done formerly, on all developing social structure, on all national laws, and such like. It is very important to understand these circumstances, that Homo economicus ruled from the Reformation onward, that the banker type becomes dominant from the start of the 19th century. And we cannot understand public life in the civilized world in recent times if we do not see in it the history of the dominance of banking. Toward the end of the 19th century, there arose what I already spoke of in 1908 in my lecture series in Nuremberg. In the first half of the 19th century, and a little way on into the second half, the owner or bearer of money was dominant as an individual. But then this principle of dominance changed so that money itself became dominant. In the first half of the 19th century, individuals were dominant as bankers. If you recall, I gave an example to illustrate this. I told you how the King of France once sought to, in quotes, tap money from Mr. Rothschild in Paris. Now, if Rothschild is going to be tapped for funds by the King of France, this tells us, doesn't it, who is really in charge? Kings don't, of course, do their own tapping of funds directly. The king sent his minister, finance minister, as this kind of minister of economic affairs is known, who arrived when Rothschild was just busy with a leather dealer. Rothschild's servant told the envoy from the King of France to wait in the anteroom. The finance minister of the French king regarded this as highly unusual. To be kept waiting while Rothschild talked to a leather dealer? He should wait? No, thank you. Instead of waiting, he pulled open the doors himself and announced that he was there in the name of the King of France. Quote, do take a seat a moment, close quote, said Rothschild. The minister could not begin to comprehend such treatment. Quote, but I am the envoy of the King of France, he said. Quote, well, take two seats then, but please sit down, close quote. You see, at that time a particular individual banker held sway. But this gradually passed into the reign of shares and banknotes themselves. And gradually we sailed on into the era when individual owners of money are no longer the chief thing, but the abstract accumulation of capital. Someone can be rich today and poor tomorrow. Individuals themselves rise and fall. But the joint stock or public limited company, the abstract corporate in quotes, person, as I showed in Nuremberg in 1908, became dominant instead. And thus human evolution arrived at an extreme, most outward point. You see, as soon as money itself rules or reigns, as soon as it is the driving engine, the time has arrived when the mere cash figure, money itself, must be succeeded by realities. Now, money is the most spiritual element in the economy. It is the aspect of the economy that can only be comprehended spiritually. And money only has a spiritual value, one that exists solely in human acknowledgement or evaluation. You can eat bread and meat, but not money. If money is recognized, you can acquire useful things by means of it. It has only an inner soul or spiritual value, a conceptual value, a value in thought. And the time has arrived when something must change in evolution, from the purely economic, spiritual value of money, to what is really grasped in the spirit. And now the social insights that need to be fostered through threefolding should follow directly from the dominance of the most highly abstract economic entity of money. The darkness and obscurity of social insights amongst people today must give way to illumination. Now imagine, and there's a drawing, that this represents a person from birth to death. The person gains social insight in this first life into the fact that society, social structure, is not founded on the monetary value at work in it, but on social understanding. Then the person passes through the portal of death, passes through the time until his next birth, and then lives from birth to death again. The social insight a person acquires between birth and death also, of course, lies inwardly in him, and above all enters the sleeping will, as I described it yesterday. And it is this that is born through the portal of death. Thus a person bears his social insight into death and through to the moment of cosmic midnight, bearing it then onward through birth and into his next life on earth. What becomes of this acquired social understanding, these social insights, in the following life? This great question is one we must ask today. These insights become understanding of karma. In other words, the present era of humanity's overall evolution is one when humankind must acquire social understanding, for it brings understanding of karma in a following incarnation. But no one can acquire social insights except by acquiring understanding of the spirit. You see how things are interrelated, how social understanding is dependent on spiritual understanding, on a spiritual grasp of the world and outlook, and how, in turn, this social understanding can give rise, as human evolution continues, to the necessary perception of destiny. When people pass through the portal of death with social insights, and subsequently are reborn, they will come to understand their destiny in their following life. This is the important thing, for us to fully recognize how things are connected, interrelated, in humanity's earthly evolution. We live in an era when social insights are necessary, and we will be reborn in an era when individuals will understand their destiny. It is truly no abstract impulse to say that social understanding is necessary today, for it is ultimately connected with earthly humanity's inmost evolutionary impulses. This is what I wish to impress on you today, my dear friends. Next time we will speak further of these things. The lectures in Zurich, as you know, the public lecture tomorrow will be held in Basel, have to be postponed for 2 days due to a change of lecture hall. The first lecture will take place on 24 October, and then there will be lectures on 25, 26, 28, 29, and 30 October, and then a Eurythmy performance in Zurich on the 31st of October. This means I won't be able to give the lectures here next weekend. For those of you who have the time and inclination for this, therefore, I will continue this series next Thursday at 7:30. The end of Lecture 9.